You're listening to Daily Paul Radio. Revolutionary talk for revolutionary times. WGRR Digital.
Welcome to Blue Republican Radio. This is me, Robin Kerner, the original Blue Republican, and I have an extremely special episode for you tonight. I am speaking to someone whose name you may not know, but he works very closely with a man whose name you definitely do know. When most people say UKIP, they in this country, in the United States, they probably think of Nigel Farage, but what most of them don't know is that the chairman of UKIP is a gentleman called Stephen Crowther. Steve is my guest today, and I hope you've been watching enough of what's going on in world politics to know that recently there was, as Nigel Farage has called it, an earthquake in British politics. For the first time in more than 100 years, a non-main party, a third party, has won a national election, and that third party was UKIP. And UKIP's very interesting for us in the Liberty Movement because they are the one party that really, in Britain, that anybody's ever heard of, that anybody's voting for in great numbers, that call themselves, with a small L, a Libertarian Party. They have had an electoral success recently, pulling about 28% of the national vote in the recent European elections. That's an electoral success that the Libertarian Party of the United States can frankly right now only dream of. And indeed, if libertarians in the Republican Party had 28% of the Republican Party, we'd probably be pretty excited about that too. So I am hoping that we can learn something from the chairman of UKIP, Steve Crowther, who's with me here today. Steve, thank you so much for joining me.
It's an enormous pleasure, Robin.
It is for me too. I've been very excited about this, and I know we've been doing emails back and forward, and I know you are in more demand now than perhaps you've ever been, as far as the media is concerned in the UK.
Well, that's true. I like to keep myself out of the media spotlight as much as possible, and my party likes me too as well, because I'm an elderly white male, and that doesn't necessarily appeal to the media. But I, in the last week, there have been a number of overnighters where boring people had to sit in studios trying to pontificate about incoming election results, and then turn up outside the Palace of Westminster in the morning at some ridiculous hour. And for some reason, I seem to be told off to do all of that stuff.
I sympathize. Actually, Steve, I saw you, I think, on the BBC just 3 or 4 days ago as the results were coming in. I was watching them on the BBC online, and there you were. So I feel very honored that you've gone from the BBC via whichever other outlets to Blue Republican Radio, of all things.
Robin, I needed a breath of fresh air, Robin.
Oh, there you go. Well, you have a lot of very fresh air down there in Devon. Devon is kind of known for its fresh air.
It certainly is.
But we will try and give you some more. So, okay, Steve, there are so many questions that I want to ask you. As I mentioned to you before the show, when we had a little chat, the Liberty Movement in the US is burgeoning for sure. And I've been saying and writing that there is a lot that they can learn from the success of UKIP. And therefore, most libertarians, most people in the Liberty Movement, have been very excited to see what you guys have been doing over the last, well, few years, culminating in this recent election. But there are this hardcore that are very skeptical that you're libertarian at all. Now, I got online and checked your constitution, and the party's constitution. It clearly says you are a democratic libertarian party. Small d, small l, right? So now I listened to you speak, Steve, in Devon, and it's clear to me that, first of all, you're very eloquent, so I do know why the party wants to put you up in front of the media, but that you know what libertarian means. I think you may have read some of the books. You use those expressions, small government, self-government, and indeed the word libertarian at the end of the meeting where I met you. So can you just unpack that? When UKIP says it's a libertarian party, what does that actually mean in the context of UK politics? And I noticed that in all of the things that I've heard from UKIP and from people like yourselves, representatives of UKIP, I haven't actually heard the word libertarian used per se. So can you kind of explain that? Where are you situated vis-a-vis libertarianism, classical liberalism, whatever you want to call it?
Very interesting question. You mentioned that we use in our constitution the word libertarian with a small L. And I think that's a key point. We also are essentially a party that's very often considered conservative, but we always say, well, yes, but with a small c. I think one of the problems is that if you decide that you're going to be a somethingist, you are automatically going to then put yourself down some sort of channel. And you have to live up to your own image at that point. You know, if we say, I'm going to be a libertarian party, and that's the most important thing, then there are all kinds of exciting things that happen then, and we've experienced some of them ourselves, which is I had an interesting time a year or two ago when I had to invite the head of our youth wing to leave being head of our youth wing.
I love the way you put that.
Sorry?
I love the way you put that, Steve. You had to invite him to leave. Sounds very English.
because he was very much on the libertarian wing of our party, and essentially what he thought that meant was that he could do what he liked. Now that's all very well. I respect his life decision in that, but as somebody that tries to run a political party, I had to explain to him that if you are an absolute libertarian, clearly that's rather incompatible with the concept of a party. And we are a political movement which has libertarian instincts, conservative instincts, small government instincts, small tax instincts. Our political philosophy comes from essentially an inherent distrust of government.
Mm-hmm.
That's why we started out and how we started out and why our primary movement, our primary cause is to get this country out of the European Union. Because the European Union is another layer of government that has been superimposed on all of our national governments and is intended to create a hemispheric government, which is all part of this wonderful teenage idea that if only there were one big government in the world, everything would be lovely. Now, we all believe that when we're 13 and we're interested in politics. Most of us grow out of it, but some of us unfortunately don't, and then they create things like the European Union. And UKIP was founded specifically with the goal of getting Britain out of the European Union. So we have those instincts. Our instincts are libertarian. They are laissez-faire to a degree. They are leave me alone and I'll live my life. I will take responsibility for it and just get off my back.
Now, when you're explaining that at meetings like the one where I met you, Steve, to what extent are you actually teaching that philosophy? To what extent do the people who are supporting you, the electorate en masse, identify as also having libertarian instincts? Because when you hear a lot of the reasons why people voted UKIP, what you're seeing, what you're hearing a lot, and this is no bad thing, is that Farage, that UKIP the party, is the only party speaking to their concerns, but their concerns on certain issues. They're not saying so much that there is, you know, oh, it's so great, UKIP is the first party since Thatcher that actually is serious about smaller government or has libertarian instincts. They go to the specifics rather than this, you know, this philosophical substrate that you're telling me about here. So is that going to be a problem going forward? And to what extent are you explicit with potential voters about these libertarian instincts?
Well, I don't think that, perhaps it's a British thing, Robin, you'll be able to judge, but we don't tend to get overly philosophical. What we tend to do is to be quite pragmatic and practical. And where we're drawing our support is from people right across the traditional voting spectrum in this country who have suddenly, or indeed not suddenly, but over a long period of time, come to realize that the political class, the elite politicians in our country, have effectively all coalesced into a thing that they call the center ground and are using about 140,000 voters as the swing to enable each of them to take their share of government. And that actually, the way we think as ordinary people is not really considered suitable. The great lesson of the last campaign that we've just finished fighting, where we were getting so close to winning this election, which we ultimately did, that the mainstream political parties, Conservative, Labour, Liberal, Democrat, and the media that support them and surround them, really delivered a huge onslaught of insult and opprobrium, really directed in our direction. They would ferret out all of the social media utterings of every one of our council candidates and find the ones that don't know how to keep it quiet. And they would, you know, emblazon all of these across the newspapers. So-and-so is homophobic, so-and-so is a racist, so-and-so this, that, and the other. And it's true that some of them are people that we really had to distance ourselves from, but most of them were just people saying what normal people say.
Steve, you know what? We're just coming to the end of this segment. We will carry that on when we come back. Thank you. Welcome back to Blue Republican Radio with me, Robin Koerner, speaking to the chairman of UKIP, perhaps the most exciting political party in the world right now. When we went into the break, Steve, you were talking about the extreme, maybe even excessive media scrutiny that some of the UKIP candidates have been getting and what the media have been trying to do with what they have been finding. Carry on your thought.
Yeah, I mean, I think the key point is, as I say, we have some people within our candidate cadre who express views that are unpalatable and indeed what we would regard as not in keeping with the values of the party. So when those are surfaced, what we do is we look at those and we say, I'm sorry, but you're really not upholding the values of the party. But there are others where we say, well, okay, you're maybe expressing yourself badly or you're maybe saying things which are pretty near the knuckle, but we have to take a decision as a party whether or not we're trying to be squeaky clean, sanitized, like the other parties, and, you know, shut you down, or whether we're actually saying, well, okay, you know, you're maybe not representing party policy, but you have a right to speak your mind. And that is the key difference that has come out through this campaign, is that a huge number of people on the doorsteps, and this has been reflected in the voting, are people who have said, I am voting for you because you speak your mind. I'm voting you because Nigel Farage says what he thinks. And indeed, sometimes he says, and it's happened during this campaign, he says, do you know, I didn't put that properly. I wish I'd said it differently. It's not exactly what I meant. And people love that from a political party because it is representing the fact that politics isn't always, doesn't have to be and shouldn't be, constantly sanitized, constantly
absolutely
asking for permission, you know, constantly everything the same. So that has been a great feature of UKIP, and it's why we're pulling in people from right across the voting spectrum, as I said earlier.
Yeah, I mean, certainly, you know, Britain is dripping in the political correctness that goes with you know, this kind of social democracy that you see all over Europe and has definitely infected England since before Thatcher, but, you know, it's been on a steady climb since. And people are sick of it, and people feel that their communications are managed, and authenticity goes an awful long way, and is unusual, right, in politics in a lot of places.
Well, that's right. I mean, interestingly, Nigel has taken some stick for appointing as our candidate in the current Newark by-election a member of the party who has said some things in the past about his attitude to homosexuality. And Nigel has actually gone public and said, look, Roger is 70. He was brought up in a very religious background. Throughout the majority of his life, he was in a situation where he believed that homosexuality was not right. Mm-hmm. Now, he has said, I feel, you know, I've become relaxed and comfortable with this, but you can't expect him to simply change everything about everything in his life, or indeed pretend that he has. And what I've found is that people have been coming up to me in the election campaign saying that really was an important moment for them, because we tend to vilify people's opinions, particularly older people's opinions, right, and assume that because we have changed the way the society's norms work, those older people are just wrong and bad. Mm. And people have come up to me and said, you know, thank you for just making that defense. And for Nigel saying, look, you know, this is a guy's opinions. There were his opinions throughout his life. And, you know, he's not against anybody, but you've got to recognize that people have different views about stuff.
I think that is so important. I mean, I'm so glad to hear you say this, because tolerance has to work both ways. And, yes, you know, the idea that society and therefore people's norms, you know, they carry with them through a life, as you say, 70 years, that don't change over 70 years, which is a lifetime, is crazy. You know, we live with different norms, and, you know, and we have to accept, and this speaks well for a Libertarian Party, that people have different ideas of what freedom is and how to express their freedom, and that's okay too. There isn't one way of doing liberty.
Absolutely. I mean, we were noted a year ago for being opposed to the Cameron government's proposed legislation to legalize same-sex marriage. And our point at the time was not that we have anything against gay people forming lifelong commitments. It was that what was happening here was that there was a set of rights were being trumped over another set. And we said there are millions of people of faith within the country who are going to find this very, very difficult. Mm. And you haven't asked anybody. You haven't had a referendum on it. You haven't put it in a manifesto. You're just going to do it. And that is not libertarian as far as we're concerned. Libertarianism doesn't say that one lot of rights trumps another lot. It says that everybody's got to be respected.
Now, what you've just said there, Steve, it's refreshing to me to hear that from, if I may call you an English politician. Can I call you a politician? That's not an insult, right?
Well, if you must, Rob.
But I'm trying to imagine now, you know, you or another political representative on, you know, some morning news show. And I don't think they say it that way. Is there a gap between what you've just said and your messaging? Because I think certainly in England, people just look at you and go, oh, they see not supporting something that many homosexual couples would support, therefore you're reactionary and socially conservative. Are your people able, do you have enough people who can expound this just as you have?
Well, Robin, in all honesty, it's not so much about whether the people can expound it. It's about the medium. I'm talking to you. I have a lot of time to talk to you. Normally, when one is a politician on the radio or the television, one has no time and one has to give snap answers to snap questions. And going into the depth and the detail and the nuances behind these things is very difficult.
But is it your understanding, Steve, that most of the people who are, let's say, directing or making UKIP policy have the kind of understanding that you've just displayed to me?
Yes, yes. I mean, as you were right when you said tolerance worked both ways, and we are a very tolerant and thoughtful party, which believes that we don't all have to pretend that we have exactly the same regimented opinions about everything. Mm. And, you know, there is a variety of ways that people live their lives, and all of those have to be respected.
Absolutely. Now, related to this, but kind of moving into a slightly different area, and I'm aware that we've only got a couple of minutes left in this segment, so again, we can come back to this in the following segment. Obviously, the two big hooks for UKIP with the electorate have been the EU and immigration. I'm talking over certainly this recent election cycle. And immigration is a huge concern in Britain for many reasons, which you probably don't have time to get into. Now, it occurs to me that the real problem that Britain is facing with respect to immigration. The borders open to about 450 odd million people, which, by the way, is the equivalent to opening the United States to all of China, all of South America, all of Central America, with a few left over. And by the way, all of them living just in Alaska and not across the whole United States. That's the equivalent of what's been done on the immigration front in the UK. UKIP is talking about immigration that resonates with people. As a Libertarian Party, though, am I not right in saying that you would agree that the problem with immigration is really a problem of the welfare state? It's not borders per se. It's borders plus welfareism. If that's true, again, I so often hear UKIP talking about immigration without reference to welfareism, but it seems like welfareism is the underlying problem here. Do you see what I'm getting at?
I do, but actually I don't agree.
Okay.
It's a straightforward thing with us. And you know, immigration is, again, the label that is put on this. Our issue is, as you say, with the EU's open borders policy. The EU's open borders policy means that all citizens of the European Union, the other 27 nations that are not the UK in the European Union, have a perfect right to come and live and work in the UK. And many of them do, and they are fine people who do a great job of work and are entirely upstanding. The problem that we identify is that many of them come from countries whose average income is very much lower than our own.
You know what, Steve? Hold this thought. We'll come back and do this in the next segment because we're going into another break.
Guard against the acquisition of unwarranted influence by the military-industrial complex. The potential for the disastrous rise of misplaced power exists. We must never let the weight of this combination endanger our liberties or democratic process.
The War State by Michael Swanson is a must-read for anyone interested in the critical 20 years after World War II, when the United States morphed from a constitutional republic to a global imperial superpower. Get The War State by Michael Swanson from Amazon.com today.
Welcome back to Blue Republican Radio with me, Robin Kerner, the original Blue Republican, speaking to Stephen Crowther, the chairman of UKIP, inspired by what might be the greatest libertarian political insurgency that I've seen in the country of my birth in my lifetime. Steve, when we went into the break, we were talking about the problem of immigration in the UK, and you said that you disagreed with me that this was a problem of welfareism, and you're starting to talk about how we've opened the borders to people from countries that are much poorer, much lower GDPs than Great Britain. Please carry on with that thought.
Yes, and this is another of the issue. I do not blame anyone from the eastern parts of Europe that until fairly recently were behind the Iron Curtain for using their right to come to the UK and work here and get the kind of wages that are available within the UK. I blame our government for putting us in a situation where they cannot control that situation. And therefore, two things happen. First of all, our own working class essentially find that there is massive competition in cheap labor competition for their jobs. And the second thing is, other people who wish to immigrate to the UK from other places, such as the Commonwealth, non-Europeans, are disproportionately handicapped in their ability to do so because our governments are trying to exercise some futile control over immigration where they have open borders to 450 million people in Europe.
Now, a lot of libertarians would say, you know what's coming, right?
I do.
Right, okay. So they would say, well, we like competition. We like competition in goods, services, and labor. So you've got 450 million in. The answer here is open the borders to the rest of the world. You know, it's not that you close them off to the Eastern Europeans. It's that you open them up to everyone, and then what a libertarian paradise we would have.
Yeah, I think that's why we are not a libertarian party with a big L that is out there trying to be libertarianer than thou.
Interesting.
We are looking at the practical consequences of having open borders to 450 million people. We do not see an advantage in simply having fully open borders to everyone, because we believe that as a country we should be managing the way that we live and the way that we progress. And we believe that if you have absolutely no ability to tell next year how many people will be in your country, it is extremely difficult to provide these services. And by that, I don't just mean welfare, I also mean roads.
Right.
And trained medics and school places and so on that you require for your population. And that, if that makes us not a pure libertarian party, then I'm perfectly happy with that.
Now, see, that's interesting. This speaks to something, a big topic of mine, which is the, you know, the dangers of purism, how that you can often, you know, the perfect can often become the enemy of the good in politics once you let dogma have too strong a hand, even if you insist that your dogma is liberal or libertarian.
Dogma is almost always going to be something that is going to bite your ankle.
Absolutely. And I think dogma is always illiberal, whatever is in the packet. If the packet is dogma, you have a problem.
It is by definition, surely.
Yes. You see, this is great, Steve. I feel like you've been reading my articles. I know you haven't, but I feel like you have. This is good. Now, you actually mentioned in your answer, you said something about number of medics. You mentioned medics. Now, obviously, this is kind of interesting, because in the UK, we have the National Health Service. And interestingly, next to the monarchy, I think it's the most widely approved of institution in the United Kingdom, more or less.
Yes.
Now, many Americans, not even libertarians, just kind of people who broadly call themselves conservatives, of course, are horrified by this notion of socialized healthcare. It's a huge, huge issue right now with Obamacare, which has been something of a disaster. How does a party with libertarian instincts, even, you know, not libertarian dogma, but libertarian instincts, operate in a culture where private medicine, the private delivery of healthcare, is basically now an anathema? The idea of self-defense and, you know, the ability, the right to own arms, to, you know, defend yourselves with firearms, for example, is a cultural anathema. How do you operate in that kind of a culture? Do you just not go there? Do you just say, you know, the issue of socialized medicine and of self-defense, let's say, has been settled, there's just no point talking about it? Or do you go to those areas of politics to make your broader philosophical case as a small L libertarian party?
I think you're confusing small L and big L there, Robin. You've started with a premise there that I'm kind of not on board with.
Okay.
We in this country invented the National Health Service after the last war, and the idea of a society in which healthcare is provided free to anyone that needs it is almost unchallengeably a good. It's apple pie. The economic consequences, I will confess to you, I don't understand the whole argument about Obamacare. That when I say I don't understand it, doesn't mean I oppose it, just means I don't understand it. I was brought up in a country where there is a National Health Service and you get free health care. Now, the issues of managing and paying for such a thing are things that are very present in our politics, and they are the biggest problem that anybody faces in attempting to be political in the UK.
Mm-hmm.
You then, oddly, in my view, linked that to firearms, but I will give you a similar answer, which is I grew up in a country where the police were not armed. I like that. I like a country where nobody is armed rather than a country where everybody is armed. And I think that's pretty much the center of gravity for my party.
Okay, so you know, that's interesting. The reason I use those two examples in the same breath is because the right to self-defense is basically, I don't want to say it's a litmus test for liberty, political liberty in the US, but it's close to it. The same with socialized medicine. They're almost seen as just kind of contradictions, that you can't be libertarian in any sense of the word if you don't believe in the right to self-defense, you know, with the equalization of force that is represented by guns, you know, the idea of government taking over a massive part of the economy that is, you know, health and medical services in the U.S.
Can I ask you a question, Robbie?
Please.
Let's leave the guns aside for a minute, because, mm-hmm. as I say, being British, I find that very difficult to talk about. But let's talk about socialized medicine. If I were to say to you that the state or the society, let's put it that way, society was able to provide you with limitless amounts of medical care and it would cost you nothing, would you still, as a libertarian in the US, consider that an infringement of your rights?
Definitely. I would say 90% of people listening to this show would. Yes.
I'd like to know the argument for that.
Well, we could do that, but I don't want to be the one answering your questions and losing this time with you. It's just the idea that when you give politicians the right to make decisions about life or death, you end up in the first of all, that's illiberal on its face, but you end up with a situation with respect to the provision of the service that in the end is like the queues that you would get for food in Soviet Russia. I mean,
I do understand the picture you're painting. And of course,
the free market works, Steve, is what I should say, and the free market should be allowed to work in healthcare. I guess that's the short answer.
Okay. What I will say is we have started with a premise, and certainly the public premise in the UK is that essentially the state, the society, provides limitless free healthcare and it costs us nothing. We clearly are aware, and successive governments are aware, that that is a situation that is extremely difficult to maintain. But we do cherish the principle. And I think we will go on cherishing the principle. What we have to do is to come to terms with how we actually manage to deliver something that lives up to it to some degree.
Okay, because just on that point where you said, and it costs us nothing, just to be clear for my listeners, the principle of the National Health Service in England is that it's free at the point of delivery.
Yeah.
Right. So when Steve here is saying
that it costs us nothing, it costs us plenty of tax.
Right. And so the libertarians right now who are listening to this in the United States, they're shifting uncomfortably in their seat going, the things that the government tries to provide for free are exactly the things that ends up costing society the most, being delivered at a declining quality with a declining efficiency. And so in the end, it's one of those, you know, the road to hell is paved with good intentions, great intention, but it just never works in practice, especially when you're socializing such a large part of the economy as is implied by a National Health Service.
Well, I think I would agree with you that it's extremely difficult to make an ideal of that kind work in practice. And indeed, all governments are finding that it is extremely difficult, particularly with the changing demographic, you know, an aging population, with the expectations that the NHS should be able to cure you of everything. And so on. However, I find it more difficult to then say, right, therefore we should change the principle. What I think we should do is to cherish the principle and then say, let's work out how much of it we can make work and the degree to which we can make it work and how much of 100% we can deliver.
And would a good answer, would UKIP's answer to that be to reduce the scope of free delivery of healthcare, so that it maybe concentrates more on catastrophic care rather than, let's say, elective care or...
Robin,
yep.
I'm going to tell you now, I'm going to do a very politician thing. I'm going to say to you, wait for our manifesto.
And when I see this manifesto, I'll be happy, and all my listeners who might care to read it would be happy that it's going to be a laissez-faire, free market, common sense approach to the political situation.
I'll take common sense out of that list.
Mm.
And I'll say it will be a common sense approach and an economically viable approach to maintaining what is a very cherished principle of the electorate in this country, which is the attempt to deliver as near to 100% of a free healthcare service as it is possible to do.
Oh, when I said that in the laissez-faire, I wasn't just talking about the health service. I was talking across the board, the principles that would be underlying all of the elements of UKIP's manifesto.
Well, our manifesto will be, as you would expect, it will be about limiting the powers of government while providing the services that are required for the people of the country.
And we should say, Steve, I think it's probably fair to say, to any of the libertarians who think, oh, this isn't for real, that actually in the UK, that is itself politically, that's dramatic, isn't it? Because there really isn't there's none of the other main parties that actually approach politics in that way.
Well, the Conservatives would claim to. But the thing that I think, I'd like to go back to something that we talked about earlier in this interview, which is the reason why UKIP has grown into what it is and the reason why what informs our political stance is our insurgency against the European Union. Now, that in a sense is totemic. Mm. Why is it? It is because we looked at the European Union and said there is a super government that is being created to rule us all above the government we already have, and we don't like that. The more government is not good. Less government is much better. And that is what informs us. It is,
yes.
Leave us alone. Give us the services that we collectively as a society require you to give us. And other than that, let us live our lives unhindered and, you know, with a sense of personal responsibility and to achieve what we can achieve.
I've got to say that, and I've written this recently, that I do think of all of the policies of any party in the UK right now, if implemented, withdrawal from the EU would do more for liberty than any other one of them, in my opinion. And I think that alone gives you a huge claim.
I would totally agree with that, because the European Union is an exercise in increasing government. That's the whole point. It's about harmonizing, essentially creating a single state across continental Europe, and indeed as widely as it can possibly reach, and it has tried to reach into the Ukraine, and it's trying to reach into Turkey. And the idea, what it didn't notice in doing so is that in order to create a single state, which effectively therefore has no history, it has to write all of the rules.
Right.
It has to start by writing an enormous rule book. And that is what it is being setting out to do. Yes. And that is why we have this constant stream of legislation, regulation, and so on coming from Europe, is because it is trying to write a new set of rules that everybody will obey and that are not based on our history, but are based on a bunch of people sitting in Brussels thinking it up.
And by definition, therefore, are the antithesis of common law, which is what underlies the Anglo tradition of liberty for 1,000 years.
Well, Robin, if you talk about my personal motivation, there are many reasons why I dislike the European Union, but the one thing that absolutely is at the root of it for me is that common law is the most advanced form, in my view, of legal code for a society, because it has grown up by precedent, by social action, by layer, by layer, by layer, by, you know, with all kinds of influences. But it reflects the country that we are. It reflects where we've come from. It reflects a lot of thinking.
Absolutely.
And to simply trash it and say, well, let's actually try and write from scratch a legal code that will apply to ourselves and 27 or 37 other countries and make that work as well, seems to me to be entirely dangerous and wrong. And indeed, the common law engenders in the British tradition, Magna Carta and so on, habeas corpus, engender a lot of protections of human and civil rights, which essentially the European Union is now trying to reinvent.
Absolutely.
And it is my belief that politicians generally, when they try and reinvent things, do it badly.
Yes, we'll give the Anglo history of tradition, the Anglo 1,000-year history of liberality, more faith than what the Eurocrats are doing now. We're going into another break. So hold on, please. We'll be right back. been a very interesting hour with Steve Crowther, the chairman of UKIP. And in the last 2.5 minutes of the show, I want to ask him a question that a lot of the media have been pressing UKIP to answer, which is this. A lot of people who see European, the European Union rightly as a soft tyranny turning hard, would consider voting, obviously, UKIP, or some of them prefer the idea of voting Conservative, because the Conservatives are saying if they win a general election, they will provide a referendum on our being in or out of Europe. And so a lot of people are saying that UKIP, by standing against the Tories, the Conservative Party, are splitting the anti-European vote on, they say, the right, but that's a crass generalization, but let's say splitting the right, and will let the left, the current Labour Party, and the man's name is Miliband, that he would be the lefty prime minister that we would end up getting, would take Britain in completely the wrong direction, in a direction opposite from the one that either the Tories or UKIP want to see. I certainly am very scared for my country to think that Miliband might be the next prime minister. So what is, in the last minute and a quarter that I've left you, Steve, what's UKIP's take on that?
Well, it's quite simple. It is the Conservatives rather than Labour who have made all the main moves in taking us into the European Union since 1961, ably assisted by the American government, by the way. Labour is a relatively new convert to the European project. The Conservatives have been saying at every election since then, oh, hang on, we mustn't, be careful. Since we've been around, they've been saying, oh, don't vote UKIP because we'll let Labour in. And I just say to them now, okay, well, when are you going to stop doing that? If you can't say on one day to me, well, I think the European Union is a bad thing and we're losing our identity and becoming part of the United States of Europe. And then on the next day say, oh, but we've got to vote Conservative again, because otherwise we'll let Labour in. Because this just goes on and on and on, and eventually you just lose all credibility.
And in the last 15 or so seconds that we have, Steve, does the fact that they're legislating for the referendum in 2017 not make a difference?
They've made it perfectly clear that they intend to vote to campaign for us to stay in. In 2017, we are the rotating president of the EU, so they will be putting a lot of propaganda about the fact that we appear to be in charge of it for 6 months. It makes no difference at all. We need to have a referendum. We need it now.
Thank you so much, Steve. This has been a fantastic hour. Thank you for joining me with Steve Crowther. Appreciate your time, Steve. All the best to you, sir.
Thanks, Robert.
Revolutionary Talk for Revolutionary Times, WGRR Digital.